Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. It runs March 3rd to 23rd in communities across Canada. La Fondation canadienne pour le dialogue des cultures, in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association through the Community Radio Fund of Canada and this station, present the RBF series January through March of 2016. For more information, check out www.ncra.ca/RBF.
My name is Christian Gagne, and I live in Windsor, Ontario. I'm a volunteer programmer at CJAM 99.1 FM, the local campus community radio station, and I do a French music show, une émission de musique francophone que s'appelle On y va musique. The next 25 minutes are a part of Le Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, a national celebration of Francophone culture amongst the communities of Canada. I'm going to take you on a brief overview of the Francophone history of Detroit, Windsor, and Essex County. As a part of the Francophone celebrations, I am focusing on the Francophone language and culture and the people who came from France in the 17th century to create Les Canadiennes and their culture. However, in a place like Windsor, Detroit, just as those two cities must be said in the same breath, the division between the various native cultures that coexisted here and between the Francophone culture becomes quite blurry in the 18th and 19th centuries. Many people who can trace their names back to the original French pioneers of Fort Detroit or Fort Pontchartrain can also claim native ancestry. The focus of this radio project is Le Rendez-vous de la Francophone. Perhaps in the future, I can do a project on the Native and Métis cultures that have called the Detroit River area their home for hundreds or even thousands of years. And we can call it Le Rendez-vous d'Indienne d'Amérique. If you look at a map of the Windsor, Detroit, Essex County area, you will see many geographical names of French origin. Detroit itself is a French word. La Salle, Pesh Island, Boblo Island, Pointe Pelee, Pointe aux Roches, River Canard, the Puce River, Belle River, Jeannette's Creek, Lake St. Clair. These are all French place names. Windsor is obviously an English name. The royal family's last name is Windsor. And historical records show that this name was in use by the 1840s in reference to the city across the river on the south shore from Detroit, what would become the city of Windsor. However, for 100 years, the south shore of the Detroit River was known as La Petite Côte, the Little Coast in English. It was so named because to the voyageurs who traveled up and down these waters in the 18th and 19th centuries, the South Shore was a relatively short strip of land between Lake Erie and Lake St. Clair as compared to the North Shore. And of course, then there are the street names, which are very illustrative of the original Francophone settlers. In Windsor and LaSalle, we see Bobby Street, Jeanette, Karen, Polisher, Olette, Lewis Street, Marentette, Parent, Langlois, Peary Street, Pilette, Joseph Janis Street, Isabel, Belperche, Lauzon, Dieppe, Shane, L'Espérance, Lacasse, Rayom, Bouffard, Laurier, Boismier. These names remain prominent amongst the people who live in this region to this day, the descendants of the original Francophone pioneers. In Detroit, we see a wealth of French street names. Livernoy, Bondy, Labadie, Saliot, Leblanc, Lafayette, Saint-Anne, Saint-Antoine, Dubois, Shane, Campeau, Beaufay, Marquette, Saint-Jean, Balfour, Rivaud, Grosse Pointe, Provençal, or Provençal, Vernier, Michaud, Beaubien, Riopel, Gratiot. So many French names in Detroit. These streets start at the North Shore and extend into the interior of what is now the city of Detroit and reflect the seigneurial system, a semi-feudal system of land distribution used in New France and also here in the Windsor area. This style of land distribution contrasts with the British grid pattern of square land parcels that surround the respective downtown cores of Windsor and Detroit. The earlier seigneurial arrangement survives in the street names that fringe the banks of the Detroit River. The exploration and settlement of Essex County, and indeed all of southwestern Ontario, was retarded by a great war between the Iroquois nations and the French between 1620 and 1670. It is possible that the Jesuits, the Black Robe missionaries, in the context of their missionary work with the Hurons, ventured farther south and had reached the Straits of Detroit that connected Lake Erie to Huron in the 1640s. But there are no records, and all such incursions ended with the destruction of the Huron Nation and the martyrdom of the Jesuits in 1649 by the Iroquois raiding parties. Indeed, by 1651, the whole of southwestern Ontario was the unpopulated hunting grounds of the Iroquois. In 1666, the Mohawk lodges were destroyed by a Quebec regiment, and this allowed French explorers to begin safely pushing southwest in search of the fabled South Sea that would lead them to the riches of China. In 1669, two priests, François Dollier and René Gallinet, set off from Montréal with 21 men and 7 canoes. On the south shore of Lake Ontario, they met Adrien Joliet, brother of the famous Louis Joliet, who later explored the Mississippi River with Marquette. Adrien described a recent journey where an Iroquois prisoner had shown him a new passage to the St. Lawrence via the Southern Straits. With a rough map drawn by Joliet, Dollier and Gallinet entered Lake Erie and landed at a spit of land on the north shore in March of 1670. This tongue of land they named Point Pelee or Point Pelee, which means peeled or bare in French. The point was so named because of the absence of trees on the eastern shore. A great storm destroyed their altar service and their supplies in the night, but they had no choice but to push on and take the northern route back to Quebec. Upon entering the Detroit River, they encountered a camp of natives who were paying homage to a painted stone idol on the shore. Convinced that the idol was somehow to blame for their misfortunes, Dollier and Gallinet took it upon themselves under the cover of night to smash the pagan idol with their axes and dump the pieces in the river. In 1701, there arrived on the scene one Antoine Lomé de la Mothe Cadillac, a charming Gascon adventurer with a murky past. It appears that he added the de la Mothe Cadillac to his name to make himself sound more aristocratic. He even equipped himself with a bogus pedigree, a fake coat of arms, and concealed his origin so effectively that his early life remains obscure to this day. He had a vision that a settlement established at the strategic spot on the Great Lakes would help to keep the British from moving into the West and allow the French to monopolize the fur trade in central North America. Thus, Fort Pontchartrain du Détroit was established on high ground on the north shore of the Detroit River. Cadillac encouraged the Ottawa and Huron natives to move into the area for the convenience of trading with the French, and he named it in honor of Louis Philippot, Comte de Pontchartrain, Minister of the Marine to Louis XIV. However, growth was slow, as a 20-year war with the Fox tribe caused much death and destruction in the region. Cadillac lost favor in the power politics of the times and was demoted to the Louisiana colony in 1710. By 1733, the Fox Nation had been nearly annihilated, and the settlement of the region began to gain momentum. Many of the soldiers and voyageurs who had founded Fort Detroit with Cadillac settled down with native wives, received land grants, and began farming strips of land near the fort. By the 1740s, seigneurial strips of land began being farmed on the south shore as well. However, things were not easy at first, as the shore had another name aside from La Petite Côte, the little shore. It was also known as La Côte de Misère, poverty coast due to the sandy soils that made farming very difficult, particularly on the East Shore. In 1749, the governor of the region, in a determined effort to increase the population of Detroit, issued the following proclamation in every parish along the St. Lawrence River. And I quote, "Every man who will go to settle at Detroit will receive gratuitously one spade, one axe, one plowshare, one large and one small auger. Other tools will be advanced to be paid for in 2 years only. The settlers will also be given a cow, which he shall return at the time of the increase, and the same for a sow. Seed will be advanced the first year to be returned at the third harvest, and the women and children will be supported for 1 year." End quote. And thus, a trickle of Francophone pioneers came to southwestern Ontario. By 1751, grants had been made to a number of families on the south shore of the river. Riverside Drive, and I'm looking at the last remaining Jesuit pear tree that I've been able to find in the city. Jesuit pear trees were brought here and planted by the Jesuit fathers when they settled in what is now Detroit and in Windsor in the early and mid 18th century. These pear trees were locally known as giant pear trees in the later 18th and 19th centuries, and were a source of pears for the Francophone community here. You don't see them anymore. This one indeed was severely damaged from the records that I discovered in the 70s and was repaired by a tree surgeon. You can still see the concrete patch in place to help extend the life of the tree, although it doesn't look very healthy, I have to admit, and indeed appears to be splitting down the middle. So I don't know how many more years it's going to be here, but there it is, the last remaining Jesuit pear tree, actually a European pear tree here in Windsor. I know there was one in the county that was fairly well documented in a newspaper a few years ago, and indeed it was a giant in every sense of the word. This one is a fairly normal sized tree, a tiny remnant of the history of the Francophone community here in Windsor. Hardly had the French settlers on the south shore of Detroit begun to feel secure in their possessions, wrested from the wilderness, when the Seven Years' War spread from Europe to North America, and there was a great struggle for the possession of the Ohio Valley. The British defeated the French forces at Quebec in 1759 at the Plains of Abraham. In 1760, the Fort of Detroit was turned over to Rogers Rangers, a famous frontier guerrilla regiment of the British Army and the sworn enemies of Les Canadiens and their native allies. The Rangers imposed higher taxes, British law, and confiscated weapons from the French Canadians and the natives and refused to sell them ammunition. This made the natives particularly upset, as it was a very different relationship compared to how the French had worked with them. The Canadians had formed many families through intermarriage with the natives and had practiced the sacred native custom of giving gifts. Pontiac, a war leader of the Ottawas, enraged by the British actions, rallied several tribes in what became known as Pontiac's Rebellion. From his base on Pesh Island, he attempted to capture Detroit by surprise from the British. However, a Métis girl warned the governor of Fort Detroit of the impending attack, and Pontiac was forced to lay siege to the fort. Now, the local Canadiens stayed neutral in this conflict, as they had signed loyalty oaths to the British Crown so as to avoid deportation. By the fall, the siege was lifted, and Pontiac was forced to retreat to Illinois country. In 1774, the Quebec Act was passed by the British Parliament, giving the French Canadians complete language and religious freedom, and restored the French form of civil law. By 1796, British occupation of Detroit had ended. At this time, a significant number of Francophones who wished to remain under British rule migrated to the South Shore. British colonists and United Empire loyalists settled along the southern shore of Essex County, while the Francophones spread along La Petite Côte eastward to the coast of Lac St. Clair and up the Thames River. On a map today, you can see this expansion in the French place names. There's Puce, Emeryville, Belle River, St. Joachim, Pointe-à-Roche, Jeannette's Creek, Pancourt, La Salle, River Canard, or a significant French-speaking minority in Windsor and the surrounding towns remains to this day. This is Christian Gagne, and I'm at 254 Pitt Street West, the address of the Bobby House Museum, La Maison François Bobby. It's a Windsor Community Museum, and there's a plaque right here. I'm going to read from it. This house and adjacent farmland were the property of François Bobby, who was born in 1763, died in 1856, lived a long, healthy life for those days, for any days, for that matter. He was first member for Kent in the Legislative Assembly of Upper Canada from 1792 to 96. He was a militia officer and assistant quartermaster general during the War of 1812. When the Americans invaded Canada in July of 1812, Brigadier General William Hull set up his headquarters in François Bobby's house and camped his troops on the farm. After Hull's withdrawal, British guns mounted here covered Isaac Brock's advance across the river to capture Detroit on the 16th of August, 1812. That was the commemorative plaque for the War of 1812. Then we have here the Battle of Windsor, 1838. Early on December 4th, 1838, a force of 140 Americans and Canadian supporters of William Lyon Mackenzie crossed the river from Detroit and landed about 1 mile east of here. After capturing and burning a nearby militia barracks, they took possession of Windsor. In this vicinity, they were met and routed by a force of some 130 militiamen commanded by Colonel John Prince. Five of the invaders were taken prisoner and were executed summarily by order of Colonel Prince. This action caused violent controversy in both Canada and the United States. The remaining captives were tried and sentenced at London in Upper Canada, and six were executed. 18 were transported to a penal colony in Tasmania, and 16 were deported, I presume, back to the United States. This house was restored by the Hiram Walkers and Sons Limited for the Windsor Historical Sites Association as a repository for the historical collection given by George F. MacDonald. The Curse of Pêche Île is a very interesting part of Francophone lore from the 19th century in this region. The island sits in the river near the mouth of Lac St. Clair and remains a virtual wilderness in the middle of an urban metropolis. It was used as a base for fishing by the natives and the Francophones throughout the 18th century. Indeed, at one time, Pontiac had his main camp on the island. Records from the 1780s indicate that the Laferet clan were living on the island, farming and hunting and fishing. And by the mid-19th century, everyone just assumed that they owned the island. Indeed, the family claimed that Jean-Baptiste Laferet was granted the island in 1780 for his service in the British military as a guide and interpreter. But no deed or record of this has ever been found. In 1857, the official ownership of the island was transferred to the Chippewa Indians by the British Crown, although no one seems to have paid much attention to this locally. The last Laferets on the island were Leo Laferet and his wife Rosalie Droulard, a Métis woman born on Walpole Island. Leo staked out 4 acres in 1867 when it became part of Canada and paid taxes on this property. Meanwhile, a local Windsor businessman named William Hall applied for a land patent for the 106 acres on the island in 1870, excluding Leo's 4 acres. And he received a title to the island for a payment of $2,900 to the Crown. Hiram Walker's son, Hiram Walker, he was a famous American industrialist from the good old robber baron days, and he founded the Hiram Walker's Distillery here in Windsor. His sons purchased the property from the Hall Estate in 1883, intending it to be a summer home for their father. Leo Laferet died that year, but according to Laferet's descendants, a group of Walker's men forced their way into Rosalie's home and made her and the oldest boys sign the deed over to the Walkers. Walker's men threw $300 on the table and told Rosalie to be out by the spring. That winter, while Rosalie and her family were away in Detroit on business, someone, who knows who, came onto the property, destroyed their winter stores. Now, because Rosalie was knowledgeable of the ways of the natives, being part native herself, the family was able to survive until spring. When it was time to leave, Rosalie got down on her knees and she cursed the walkers and the island and swore that no one would ever do anything with the island again. Following the eviction of the Laferettes, the curse seems to have taken hold. Willis Walker, the lawyer who handled the purchase of the island, died soon afterwards at the young age of 28. Mr. Walker himself spent years trying to develop the island. He dug canals, built a mansion and a golf course and greenhouses, planted orchards, and installed an electric generator. But he died of a stroke in 1899. His wife did not allow the locals to pick the island's peach crop, which was a tradition locally, instead forcing them to dump the fruit into the river, and had no interest in the island, and basically allowed it to decay. The grandchildren sold the island in 1907 to a Walter Campbell, who promptly died on the property. In 1929, the mansion burned to the ground under mysterious circumstances. Some say a huge lightning bolt struck it and ignited a fire. In 1926, the Hiram Walker's widow sold the distillery as it had become an unsavory way of making money. By 1935, there were no Walkers left in Windsor. Throughout the rest of the 20th century, the island changed hands several times until the province purchased it in 1971 and turned it into a park. And so Peshiel remains as it was before the Laferettes were forced off the island. And many believe it will remain so until Rosalie's curse is lifted. In the 1840s, there was a lumber boom in Essex County. Great stands of old growth, white oak, beech, walnut, and hickory, tulip, and sycamore were cut down and dragged to the sawmills to be sawed into planks. And many Francophones from Quebec came here to work in the forests as lumberjacks and in the mills. And there were gagnés that came at that time as well. Perhaps one of them was Joseph Louis himself, my great-great-great-grandfather. At any rate, in 1870, Joseph Louis Gagné purchased 100 acres in Pointe-aux-Roches and moved from Montreal with his wife and his 10 grown children. And it was a smart move. The land was cheap and fertile, the climate warm and sunny, the lakes were full of fish, birds filled the skies, nut and fruit trees were everywhere, and towering above them all were the giant pear trees. These trees had been brought here from Europe by the Jesuit priests. Some grew to be 70 feet tall and 10 feet around at the base and could produce some 40 bushels of pears in the fall. By this time, good land was becoming scarce in Essex County, and so several of the brothers pushed further west, with two settling in Michigan and one ending up in Bottineau, North Dakota. My father was born in a farmhouse on a road called the French Line, appropriately enough, just outside of St. Joachim. That was back in 1941. It's amazing to think, but he did not begin learning to speak English until it was time for him to go to high school. Today, people find it remarkable that a person could be born and live their life in Essex County back in the 40s and 50s and yet never learn any English. Well, in response, I would refer to the Canadian theme of two solitudes, which refers to a lack of communication between the English and French people that have existed in Canada since its founding. This lack of communication explains how two cultures could exist for 150 years in Essex County, the English down in the southern half, and the French in the northern half, and yet have very little to do with each other. Thus, my father grew up in Essex County, yet never learned how to speak English until he had to go to high school, and only then because there were no French high schools in the region. If you wanted to get a high school education in French, you would have to be sent to a private school in Toronto operated by the Bazilian Fathers. That my father's older brother, Pierre, that's what they did when it was time for him to go to high school. My Mémé and Pépé got the money together and sent him to this French high school in Toronto run by the Bazilians. However, they could only afford to send one son, so my father had to go to an English high school when it was time for him to graduate. And this was a very frustrating situation to my French relatives, and they took it upon themselves in the 70s, with other Francophones from the community to organize and to get a French high school built here in Windsor. Finally, in 1980, the high school called L'Essor was opened. 30 years later, the Francophone community is stronger and more vibrant than ever. There is no longer two solitudes in Windsor and Essex County. French immersion programs are flourishing in the Catholic and public school systems, and there are more bilingual speakers here than ever before. In three generations, there has been a complete reversal of attitudes regarding language instruction and Francophone culture in general. My father, growing up in the 50s, never learnt English. Myself, growing up in the 70s, I did not learn how to speak French. But my daughter, who grew up in the 90s, she went to a French immersion school and is a fully bilingual adult. Thus, there is much to celebrate today in the context of Rendezvous de la Francophonie 2016. Today, we can reach out to each other and share our cultures with pride and celebrate the rich traditions and history of Francophones at the southwestern tip of Ontario. Okay, here I am at the corner of Mill and Russell, right on the shore of the Detroit River, and I'm standing in front of a replica of one of the wind-powered grist mills that stood on the south shore of Detroit River between Sandwich and Tecumseh in the 18th and 19th centuries. There's a commemorative plaque over here. In the 18th century, numerous wind-powered grist mills stood on the south shore of the Detroit River between Sandwich and Tecumseh. Jacques Bobby's mill was located near this site on lot number 2 at the foot of Mill Street, not far from the historic Duff Bobby Mansion. During the War of 1812, the American general William Hull commandeered flour for his troops from this mill for his retreat from Sandwich. At that time, up to 50 bushels of grain per day could be ground into flour, which sold for 25 cents a pound. The Jacques Bobby wind-powered grist mill, or a replica of it anyways, standing here at the foot of Mill and Russell Street.
For more information on the Rendezvous de la Francophonie, which is an annual celebration in partnership with La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Community Radio Fund of Canada, and this station, visit www.ncra.ca/RVF.